is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Most national Democratic leaders are trying to portray a united front in support of President Biden despite Thursday's debate performance, but Representative Jamie Raskin telling Velshi on MSNBC that Democrats are having a serious conversation about what to do.
There are very honest and serious and rigorous conversations taking place at every level of our party because it is a political party and we have differences of point of view.
But a senior administration official telling ABC News that President Biden's inner circle is doubling down on Biden staying in the race. The president at Camp David today. Hundreds of people attended a vigil overnight for a 13-year-old boy killed in a police shooting in upstate New York. Police say he was pointing a replica handgun at an officer. Responding officers are now on paid administrative leave. In the Caribbean, Hurricane Beryl has undergone a rapid intensification. It's now becoming the earliest Cat 4 hurricane on record. This is ABC News.
Cool and open.
The death toll in a Russian strike on a southern Ukraine town yesterday now stands at 7, including 3 children. 43 people also injured in the strike in Vilyansk. In a statement today, President Zelensky said this week alone, Russia has used more than 800 guided aerial bombs against Ukraine. State regulators in California are taking notice of a major insurer's proposed rate hike. ABC's Brian Clark has more.
State Farm insures 1 in 5 homes in California. It recently raised rates by nearly 20%, and now it wants to bump rates by another 30%. State regulators are now concerned about State Farm's health.
It's a regulation that's really meant to address a company's financial solvency. That's what they're saying. And we're going to look closely at that.
Department of Insurance spokesperson Michael Suller says nothing's changing immediately. California is dealing with a widespread insurance crisis triggered in large part by damaging fires. Brian Clark, ABC News.
And I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
Are you and your family weather ready?
I'm Terry Barr, producer of the Slice of Wisconsin series. Wisconsin weather is ever changing, and all of us with Civic Media believe awareness can make a difference. Our weather ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The heat is on. Did you know that high temperatures are the leading cause of weather related deaths? Here are some safety tips when you're dealing with a Wisconsin scorcher. First, do not leave another person or your pet in the car. 8 kids died in hot cars in the last several years across the state, and it didn't even have to happen. Look before you lock and walk away. Work outside, keep water close, and stay hydrated. Take a break in the shade, and if you can limit time in the heat, even better. Chill out in the air conditioning or find your community's cooling shelter. And check on your family and neighbors to be sure that they're safe too. Stay cool and be cool by being weather ready. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Visit any Wisconsin farmers market and chances are you'll find Hmong vendors. Mike Moan reports on efforts to attract new and younger Hmong Americans to agriculture.
Wisconsin has the third largest Hmong population in the U.S. that, according to UW data, only 2% are officially employed in agriculture, but researchers suspect that number is underreported. Yimua Yang of the Groundswell Conservancy senses a changing of the guard with older Hmong producers nearing retirement. Some of their adult children express interest in taking over, but she adds their mindset is different than their parents.
Older Hmong farmers, farming is therapeutic for them. They're making a little bit of money, but also farming and gardening makes them happy. The difference is that these younger farmers, they want farming to be financially sustainable.
Yang says land access is a major challenge for emerging Hmong farmers, and her group is working with partners like the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute to create funding solutions to address this problem. Yang would also like to see policy adjustments dealing with how long a farmer can rent land. And there's a new federal program helping with land access, but Yang says more support is needed. She feels giving younger Hmong farmers peace of mind might inspire them to further explore what they grow and sell.
Unlike Minnesota and the Twin Cities, where there's a big concentration of Hmong consumers, in Wisconsin, the Hmong community is sort of scattered throughout the state.
That means these farmers have to focus more on marketing mainstream fruits and vegetables to non-Hmong customers. But Yang suggests if groups like hers get more bandwidth, the next generation of Hmong producers will be in a better position to grow culturally specific food. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
This is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see tons of sunshine for your Sunday and light north winds as highs top out in the lower 70s. In the overnight, clear skies, light winds will continue with lows in the lower 50s. On Monday, mostly sunny with highs in the lower to middle 70s.
It's 69 at our studios.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Representative Mark Pocan joins us to talk about National Postal Workers Day, and we'll hear from Dean Muller with Wisconsin for Environmental Justice. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your host for these two very special hours of our broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout Wisconsin and beyond. Delighted, honored to have you with me again for this special Sunday afternoon edition of our show. The reason why we're doing this, as you well know, based upon the fact that you're already a part of our presentation, our program today, is because we're focusing upon the United States Supreme Court. Just this past week, the United States Supreme Court issuing 10 major decisions, basically 9 different issues. Important for us to understand what those are all about, significant to appreciate what the Supreme Court has said, what it hasn't said in these major areas. And so we are following up with our broadcast yesterday on Saturday, June 29th, in which we began our movement, our course through 10 different decisions, 9 different topics, 10 different decisions issued by our Supreme Court in just this past week. Because of our focus upon the importance of these cases, including 5 more cases that we're going to talk about this afternoon in this special edition of Amicus, a Law Review, for just these 2 broadcast periods, we're going to ask you to do something special. Max and I are asking you, Max, my great producer here at Civic Media, the two of us are going to ask you to do something special to ensure that we capture your questions, your inquiries, and your comments about all of the content that we're offering to you this weekend. And that is either send to us an email, send to us a text, drop in the Civic Media app your question, your comment, or even do it the old-fashioned way. Write it down on a piece of paper. And when we get together again next weekend for the next regular broadcast of Amicus, a Law Review, we will be entertaining and spending a lot of time on your questions, your inquiries about all of this content. Want to make certain that you've got an opportunity to engage with me and with each other, candidly, on these important issues of our time because of the significance and the content chocked full of meaning. We're not doing that yesterday and not doing that again today, but hoping that you will retain those questions and comments so that we can digest them and respond to them in future sessions of our broadcast here on Civic Media. We know well that this coming Monday, tomorrow, the United States Supreme Court in its final public term, final public appearance of this term, is going to be announcing at least 2 more major decisions. One of them has to do with social media. We talked yesterday about the significance of a decision in which the Supreme Court, again, addressing the interaction between government and social media, said that there's nothing wrong, nothing unconstitutional, nothing in violation of the First Amendment with government, the administration in particular, reaching out to news organizations, social media providers, and encouraging them, urging them to remove things that are in the nature of misinformation, things that are contrary to what we know to be true, things that are contrary to the best interests of the community when it comes to our health and security. The Supreme Court said, yes, that's okay. There's another course of focus on the social media issue, and that's going to be the decision coming up on Monday, having to do with whether or not state legislatures can dictate to media providers and social media platform providers in particular about the circumstances under which they remove content moderation from their panels. That issue also coming up for decision as soon as tomorrow. And we're going to be taking up the results of that next weekend in our next broadcast, along with the other major decision that's going to be issued tomorrow morning. And that is the major decision in immunity. The Supreme Court plainly waiting to the last day to issue that very significant decision about whether a president of the United States of America in the Oval Office has the capacity, the legal power to engage in criminal conduct. And if so, what are the limits of that? Are there any limits on that? The Supreme Court entertaining argument in late April on whether there are limits to what a president can do within the rule of law. And the Supreme Court will tell us that on Monday, tomorrow. Why is that important? Well, for two reasons. One, it plainly animates and provides direction for the pending criminal case against Donald Trump that's still there in the district court in the District of Columbia, alleging in four counts that he engaged in election interference in the 2020 election. That is still pending. And presumably after the decisions of this Supreme Court, Judge Tanya Chutkan will be able to resume her administration of that trial in her court. That's why that's important on one count. There's a second way it's just also important, and that is it goes to the very understanding of our Constitution. Is a president above the law? Do the fundamental principles in the Federalist Papers and in the Constitution itself that envision checks and balances, that there are limits to the capacities of the branches of government to engage in behavior? What are those limits? That is an issue, a constitutional issue, an important issue that dictates in many ways what the future of our nation will be. And as I've indicated in the past, an awful lot of people surprised, including me, that the Supreme Court has even taken this issue up in the way that it has, assuming for 240 years that there is no such thing as a president who is above the law. Tomorrow, the United States Supreme Court will tell us whether or not that proposition is right, if it's wrong, and will presumably provide some direction to the lower court about the handling of that criminal case going forward and some academic instruction about what the rule of law means in America. That necessarily leads into our first discussion that is having to do with the other case involving January 6th and the so-called insurrectionists on the ground at the Capitol on January 6th in particular. We're looking at a case called Fisher versus United States. It was just decided this past week. It is among the many other cases that we talked about yesterday, those other cases, again, involving agency authorities when it comes to the Securities and Exchange Commission, this general notion about whether or not Chevron deference, no longer a part of the judicial approach to understanding what agencies do and interpreting the actions of the experts inside them, this air pollution case involving the authority of the administration to regulate pollutants that are moving across our nation, and also this other social media case, as I indicated, that focuses upon the interaction between the administration and social media providers. All of those a part of the recent docket. In these 2 hours going ahead, we're going to begin with the Fisher case, but then also talk about abortion. We're going to be talking about homelessness. We're going to be talking about bribes in the federal system. And we're also going to be talking about opioids when it comes to the decision by a bankruptcy judge to dismiss claims in the bankruptcy court in a Chapter 11 proceeding. All of that also the subject of Supreme Court cases. Let us begin with Fisher. Fisher, Mr. Fisher in particular, one of the hundreds of defendants who have been charged by the U.S. Attorney's Office, the U.S. Department of Justice, for their involvement in the attack, the riot at the Capitol on January 6th. Mr. Fisher, at the lower court level, has challenged the very statute under which, in part, he has been prosecuted. And that particular statute, as we have talked before, is Section 1512. 1512 of Title 18. Title 18 is the general criminal code in the United States of America. And it's important, as we've talked before, to think about the circumstances of this case and understand exactly what the Supreme Court is doing, because it's wrestling with specific language in Section 1512. Section 1512C says this: whoever corruptly, and corruptly is an important word, corruptly alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record or document or other object, or attempts to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or, and there's a second section, this is important, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so, is in violation of the federal law. That's what the statute says, and that's the language with which the Supreme Court wrestled to disposition just this past week. And the Supreme Court, in the end, finding that to prove a violation of this subsection of 1512, the government must establish that the defendant impaired the availability or integrity for use in an official proceeding of records or documents or objects or other things that were used in that official proceeding or attempted to do so. You might think, well, gee, isn't that just a recitation of the statute itself? And the answer is yes, it is in part a recitation of that. But it is also an affirmation that is a rejection of the theory, the position articulated, taken by the government in prosecuting Mr. Fisher and others under this statute, that they could go beyond that, that they don't have to prove that there are particular documents, that there are particular records or objects or things that you can hold in your hand that also have to be a part of this prosecution. The Supreme Court rejecting the theory under which Mr. Fisher and many others were in fact prosecuted in these cases. A major case interpreting once again this federal statute. The Supreme Court finding in the end that this position articulated by the Supreme Court, by the Department of Justice to the Supreme Court, cannot hold. A decision issued, authored by the Chief Justice, John Roberts, delivering the opinion of the court in which Justices Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Jackson all joined. Justice Jackson also filed a concurring opinion, also very interesting. And we do get a dissent. There are justices who also dissented in this case. Their names are Amy Coney Barrett and Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. An interesting grouping of justices. You've got Ketanji Brown Jackson joining the so-called conservatives, and you've got Amy Coney Barrett joining the so-called liberals, opposing what the majority has said here and finding that the government should, in fact, have been permitted to go ahead with this particular case. Now, what do we know about the underlying facts and all of this? Well, some basic statistics here. About 1,430 people have been charged in the attack on the Capitol. Of that number, about 250 or so, 17%, were charged under this section of the law, including Mr. Fisher. In the wake of this ruling, we're not certain now about the fate of about 52 people convicted only under this particular law. Mr. Fisher is not among those. There are also other charges against Mr. Fisher and many other people that will keep these cases afloat regardless of what the courts do with this. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the implications of what the Supreme Court did and did not do here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Eagle 1490 AM.
Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
banning abortion, monitoring and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name, Jim Santel. We are here in a very special edition of Amicus, a law review. Why? Because we are spending lots of time talking about these major decisions of the United States Supreme Court of just this past week, anticipating that our next broadcast next weekend is also going to be a time not only for reviewing what the Supreme Court does tomorrow on Monday morning in two major cases, but also affording you a huge amount of time to quiz me, to engage me in questions and comments about the subject matter of our broadcast yesterday and also today, and then also next weekend as well. Thank you so much for joining me. We are talking about this major case brought by the Department of Justice alleging that many rioters on the campus of the United States Capitol on January 6th engaged in a specific violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1512. The question whether or not that particular statute does in fact apply to them. The court, in a major decision authored by the Chief Justice, said that the law can be applied only to cases that concern some kind, some variety of evidence impairment, like tampering with documents. And the reason why that's significant is that, of course, virtually none of the rioters in that day, including Mr. Fisher, actually tampered with documents. Some of them may have touched them when they've gone into the offices of some of the representatives and some of the other officials there. But the federal prosecutors, again, in those cases, alleged all kinds of other things. And that included, of course, many cases involving other types of violent behavior. And one of the other reasons why all of these cases, including Fisher, is so important is because the other charges not brought under this particular statute, those remain. And those continue to be a part of the convictions or the sentencings or the pretrial proceedings that go ahead. That includes Mr. Fisher. Mr. Fisher himself, beyond charges under Section 1512, also charged under six other counts in the federal criminal code. The implications for this, again, are significant. We know that of the about 1,400 people that have been charged, about of that number, 250 or so, 17%, charged under this particular statute, 52 of them only under this particular statute. And so the United States Attorney's Office, Department of Justice, is going to have to wrestle with what one does with that. Undeniably, with respect to those cases, the cases need necessarily be charged, recharged, or otherwise addressed in some way back in the federal court. But there are other arguable implications for this particular statute, which we will talk more about. And that is that in the discrete separate case, the separate criminal prosecution against Donald Trump not named, he's not a party in the Fisher case at all, but in that case, Section 1512 is also invoked. And so the question will be whether or not the Supreme Court's opinion as to Mr. Fisher and the language in which they describe the limitations on using Section 1512 apply to Donald Trump or not. And prosecutors, of course, have accused Donald Trump of doing almost exactly what the statute does in fact contemplate, tampering with documents, among other things, through his plot to create false states of electors, claiming that he won in states that President Biden actually won. That's one of the things that Jack Smith has alleged. He has also described in pretrial proceedings, he's way ahead of this, other circumstances under which in the present charges against Donald Trump, regardless of how you interpret the Section 1512 broadly or in a narrow way, the case against Donald Trump survives. And indeed, the allegations in those four counts describe things not on the campus of the Capitol that day, but other things that can in fact involve documents and items of particular things you can hold in your hand that the statute itself prohibits. And so it is unclear whether or not Section 1512 will prohibit the government from going ahead against Donald Trump. It most certainly will be a subject for review by the trial court judge, Tanya Chutkan, when she gets all of this back in front of her. But unclear at best about whether or not it eliminates the capacity of the government to prosecute Donald Trump going forward. What we do know again, is that the majority in the Fisher case did say again that in determining the scope of this, all sorts of reasons why it is that it has to be narrowly described, and the vacation and the remanding of the matter back to the district court based upon that result. We also know that in addition to delivering what is a very large, and again commending to your reading, this opinion of the majority of the court to you, an opinion that includes about 16 pages or so, finding in the end that Section 1512 requires that the government establish that there was this impairment of the integrity, the use of an official proceeding through records or documents or objects, as the statute plainly contemplates. We also then have this very significant two other developments, actually. One of them is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson concurring separately in the result, joining the conservatives in saying that, yes, indeed, the statute does not apply here and cannot apply here. Also commend to your reading her concurrence in this. And she says that one goal in interpreting any statute should be giving effect to the intent of Congress. And she talks a lot about that purpose in her concurring opinion. Of no less importance, again, is the dissenting opinion. The dissenting opinion that is authored by Judge Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And that is an opinion in which Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan also join. They are dissenting, and they're saying that the government does, in fact, have the capacity for going ahead. And here's something that she writes. She says, opting for a narrower approach, the court, meaning the majority, declines to take Section C2, that's the portion of the statute, on its own terms. Instead, it borrows the evidentiary focus of another section to hold the defendant violates the law only by impairing the availability or integrity for use in an official proceeding of these records or documents, objects, or other things. Other means of obstructing a proceeding, say, by shutting it down, are out. That's what justice writes in her dissents. She says the interpretation might sound faithful to the statute because the limit comes from a related provision rather than thin air. She goes on to say this, but snipping words from one subsection and grafting them onto another violates our normal interpretive principles. We ordinarily resist reading words or elements into a statute that do not appear on its face. And where the Congress includes particular language, he says, in one section of a statute, but omits it in another section of the act, we generally presume that Congress did so intentionally. And then she concludes, again, as a part of her very well-written dissent in this case, the court's reasons for departing from these rules are thin. Those are her words as set forth in this dissenting opinion. She says the court's formulation does not begin to cure some statutory overlap. She says killing a person with the intent to prevent the production of a record in an official proceeding constitutes conduct that impairs the availability of the official record for that proceeding. And she goes on to describe in particularity the reasons why, in illustrations, all of this is problematic. And we're going to talk more about what Amy Coney Barrett says in her dissent and the reasons why Fisher is important, not only to January 6th, but also, once again, the upcoming prosecution of Donald Trump. Stay with us for that continuing discussion.
Listening to the Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Most national Democratic leaders are trying to portray a united front in support of President Biden despite Thursday's debate performance, but Representative Jamie Raskin telling Velshi on MSNBC that Democrats are having a serious conversation about what to do.
There are very honest and serious and rigorous conversations taking place at every level of our party because it is a political party and we have differences of point of view.
But a senior administration official telling ABC News that President Biden's inner circle is doubling down on Biden staying in the race. The president at Camp David today. Hundreds of people attended a vigil overnight for a 13-year-old boy killed in a police shooting in upstate New York. Police say he was pointing a replica handgun at an officer. Responding officers are now on paid administrative leave. In the Caribbean, Hurricane Beryl has undergone a rapid intensification. It's now becoming the earliest Cat 4 hurricane on record. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
The Brewers lose to the Cubs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers losing before a sellout at American Family Field, nearly half of them Cubs fans, as Chicago pulled off a 5-3 victory Saturday. The Cubs jumped out to an early lead with a single, then a two-run homer by Chicago's Michael Busch on just the first two pitches of the game, Brewers starter Tobias Myers.
I think a lot of it's just baseball. They were aggressive today. They know what I've been doing the last couple weeks is attacking with the four-seam, so I think they did a pretty good job of coming out and putting some good swings on some fastballs.
The crew battled back to a 3-3 tie until reliever Yoel Piamps gave up a walk and a home run to Ian Happ in the eighth, Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
You're in the major leagues and you're pitching at that time in the game. Walks are not a possibility. I mean, it's just not part of it. If you look at our pitching staff, a lot of our success, and it's been great this year, of not giving up free bases. The home run is the home run.
That's Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see tons of sunshine for your Sunday and light north winds as highs top out in the lower 70s. In the overnight, clear skies. Light winds will continue with lows in the lower 50s. On Monday, mostly sunny with highs in the lower to middle 70s. Currently 71 degrees.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
We all hear the radio ads about the IRS. They tell you to be afraid, to be scared, and they try to frighten you into calling. I'm not here to do that. Tax Relief Advocates is different. TRA is here to tell you that if you owe money to the IRS, whether it's $5,000, $50,000, or $500,000, we have a solution. It doesn't matter if you're sitting in your car, at work, or with your kids, no matter where you are, call now. 800-496-2714. Don't lose hope. TRA can eliminate or reduce what you owe to the IRS.
Generous programs are now available that can give you a fresh start.
Our passion is taxes and helping individuals fix their IRS problems.
We have over 1,000 five-star reviews on Google and an A-plus with the Better Business Bureau.
You don't need to be afraid of the IRS any longer. End your tax nightmare today by visiting us online at TRA.com or call 800-496-2714. That's 800-496-2714. Tax Relief Advocates. Real solutions for real people.
An unsuspecting driver at a Milwaukee barbershop.
I got an apprentice here shadowing me. I'll put this hot towel on, man. About a good 3 minutes, all right?
The apprentice is Donald Driver.
So when you come here, you drive?
Yes.
Your car got seatbelts?
Yeah.
You wear them?
No.
Okay, but why not?
Because I don't want to.
But do you know you can get a ticket for that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a ticket. Bet you wish you buckle up now.
Oh, my God. Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Take it, click it. There we go.
Click it or ticket.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
Pete Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, DJ Olbrus joins me to talk about Riverfest Lacrosse. And from the Green Bay Children's Museum, Heather Heil is in studio to talk 4th of July in Green Bay.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba. Weeknights 7 till 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Jim Santel. I am your host on this edition of Amicus, a law review, a special edition on this Sunday afternoon, reviewing, analyzing, and engaging in discussion of these major cases issued by our United States Supreme Court just this past week. Continuing that discussion now, focusing upon this Fisher case, which does indeed derive from prosecutions of Mr. Fisher for his involvement in some of the violent activity on the campus of the Capitol on January 6th, and that of others as well. Plainly a case that will necessarily require that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, a section, a unit, if you will, of the Department of Justice, address Fisher to resolve these cases in which some defendants are exclusively charged under this statute. Many others, including Mr. Fisher, also charged under other statutes, and therefore prosecutions, convictions on those statutes would remain. Talking about Amy Coney Barrett's dissent, a significant dissent, again, because she departs from her so-called conservative associates on the other side of the bench, and says in particular that the interpretation, while it may sound faithful to the statute, does in fact accomplish some odd things. She says, "We ordinarily resist reading words or elements into a statute that do not appear on its face." And so goes on to describe in many ways the significance of the examples. And she describes those with some particularity in her dissent. In the end, Amy Coney Barrett finding based upon her view, and as she says, there's no getting around it. She says Section 1512 sub C sub 2 is an expansive statute. She acknowledges that. Yet Congress, not this court, weighs the pros and cons of whether a statute should sweep broadly or narrowly. Once Congress, she says, has set the outer boundaries of liability, the executive branch has the discretion, in this case meaning Jack Smith, the U.S. Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office, has the discretion to select particular cases to prosecute within those boundaries. By atextually narrowing the section, the court has failed to respect the prerogatives of the political branches. That's Amy Coney Barrett speaking, again, joined by two of her colleagues. And for that reason, she says, I respectfully dissent. Now, it is significant, again, that the Chief Justice, in writing for the majority, takes that on. And he, in his opinion, describes, in fact, that there are other reasons why, in his view, the statute should be narrowly interpreted. He says that the surrounding words in the statute, which I read previously, suggest that we should not give this otherwise provision the broadest possible meaning. He goes on to say, although the government's all-encompassing interpretation may be literally permissible, it defies the most plausible understanding of why these subsections are conjoined, meaning the two sections are brought together. And it renders, he says, an unnerving amount of statutory text mere surplusage, meaning it's there for no particular reason. Given that subsection C2, that is the key portion of the statute, was enacted to address the Enron disaster. And yes, indeed, that's where this comes from. That's the reason why the statute was addressed, why it was legislated, why it was passed and signed by the president in the first place. And because Enron was all about financial transactions and records and documents, because of all that, the Chief Justice says, not some further flung set of dangers, which he describes as being the January 6th event, because it was about the Enron disaster and not those further flung set of dangers, it is unlikely, he says, that Congress responded with such an unfocused and grossly incommensurate patch. We therefore decline to adopt the government's interpretation, which is inconsistent with the context from which the statute arose. We've got disagreements inside the Supreme Court, as we often do, on the interpretation here of a federal statute. Right now, to the benefit of many of the federal defendants, not a great many of them, but a few who've been charged exclusively under this statute. Those cases have to be revisited by the U.S. Attorney's Office there. Mr. Fisher plainly identifies this as a victory, although once again, his conviction under other counts remains, and so he is not released from federal custody, is not released under the terms and conditions of this decision in Fisher. Again, the significance of it, not only for many, more than a few defendants on the campus of the Capitol on January 6th, but also for Donald Trump. There is no doubt that as this case goes back to Tanya Chutkan, she will have before her motions by the defense, appropriately filed. That's what defense attorneys are required to do, mandated ethically to defend their clients. A motion to dismiss two of the four counts, that is forthcoming. It's already pending, if you will, effectively before Tanya Chutkan. But this case will be resurrected again in front of her, and she will then have to resolve whether in the wake of this decision, following this decision, that anything has changed, and whether she decides to agree with the government that there are interpretations of the statute that are in fact applicable to the conduct of Donald Trump in particular that separate him out, that his circumstances, the facts in the indictment against him, are very different from the facts with which the Supreme Court was wrestling in Fisher. She comes to that determination, all four counts survive. If, on the other hand, she determines, based upon the motions and the arguments offered by the defense, that the defendant here should in fact get a so-called benefit of this opinion, then those cases get dismissed. And we could have further proceedings at the appellate court level, arguably before the Supreme Court, on that issue as well. It is one, plainly, of two of the major issues pending before the Supreme Court. The other one, of course, the big one, which is immunity from prosecution at all. That, again, coming out on Monday. The point of even the Fisher case is that in the wake of this decision, almost certainly requiring that Tanya Chutkan, the federal district court judge, review this once again, very highly unlikely that the trial of Donald Trump on those four counts in the federal district court for election interference will continue, will be pursued, will no jury selection at any time in this calendar year. A lot of things for Tanya Chutkan to do, going to consume months, arguably even years before all of this is resolved finally by appellate courts. But this past week, the court limiting the applicability of Section 1512, not just for the January 6th defendants, but for anybody else who may be prosecuted by the government. The government now obliged by virtue of this opinion to tailor future indictments presented for consideration by a grand jury to the specific language, the more limiting, the narrow view of Section 1512, a big case in terms of interpretation of a federal statute out there. We'll look forward to see what Tanya Chutkan does with this down the road in the months ahead. There are other cases, plainly, that the Supreme Court also issued just this past week. Let us continue with our march through those cases. A significant abortion case. We recall well that it was 2 years ago this month, on June 24th of 2022, that a majority of the Supreme Court tried unsuccessfully to wash its hands, if you will, of the abortion issue, finding for the first time in about 49, 50 years that the United States Constitution does not have inside it, not implicit there, a privacy right to abortion. And as Justice Alito wrote in the majority opinion, sending all this back to the states where it should be, the elected representatives he spoke about in that majority opinion, obviously the subject of great dissents on the other side, that remains the law of the land. That case, of course, Dobbs overruling Roe versus Wade. Well, the Supreme Court, again, anticipating that perhaps now this issue, the abortion issue, not in front of it. We know that that was not the case. We know that earlier in this term, just a few days and weeks ago, the Supreme Court addressed another abortion-related case in finding that those people who were attacking the use and the distribution and the prescription of mifepristone, this abortion drug, those people did not have standing to bring the case in the first place. So in that other abortion case involving the use of this drug, mifepristone remains legal and accessible under the FDA prior authorizations of it. This is the second case involving abortion. It involves the state of Idaho. And the question is whether or not the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act requires hospitals to provide stabilizing treatment even in the state of Idaho in cases where pregnant women need health emergency attention and stabilizing treatment for their lives and livelihoods. The state of Idaho has a Defense of Life Act that prohibits virtually all abortions and so poses a seeming legal conflict with that federal rule. This case is Moyle versus United States of America, the second major abortion case before the Supreme Court 2 years after the case involving Dobbs. Majority of the justices voted to dismiss the case, reinstating a lower court ruling that had paused Idaho's near total abortion ban. Following all this, the ruling mirrored a version inadvertently posted a day earlier. And yes, indeed, this is the case in which a day before the official announcement of this case, probably through some electronic or some human error, this case was posted and then very quickly withdrawn. Now we have the official decision on Thursday of the Supreme Court saying that it would dismiss a case about emergency abortions happening in the state of Idaho, temporarily clearing then the way for women in that state to receive an abortion when their health is at risk. Significantly, the one sentence unsigned decision in this case, Moyle versus United States, declared that the case had been improvidently granted. That's the legal phrase. That's the judicial language that says we made a mistake. We should not have taken this case in the first place. We should not have granted certiorari to get the case from the lower court, meaning the majority of justices had changed their minds about the need to resolve this case as it now goes forward. It reinstates, as I said, a lower court ruling that had in fact stopped or halted Idaho's near total ban on abortion and permitted emergency abortions at hospitals if they're needed to protect the health of the mother while this case makes its way through the court. The decision, once again, does not rule on the substance of the case, but it did, in fact, basically parallel that earlier release inappropriately done. Chief Justice John Roberts announced the court's decision from the bench, as is the custom for unsigned opinions. Ketanji Brown Jackson, who in part disagreed with the court's decision and asserted the justices should have addressed the case of the merits, also read her dissent from the bench. That kind of move is rare, and it signals profound disagreement. And again, all of these cases resurrecting, if you will, once again, the abortion issue before the United States Supreme Court. First time that it has grappled with this kind of thing, a statewide restriction on abortion, as those are popping up now throughout the United States of America. And again, this is significant because of the resurgence of this particular issue and the fact that the Supreme Court here says that there is nothing more that they can do now needs to go forward at the lower court level. The so-called liberal justices, along with Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and John Roberts, all wrote or joined in some concurring opinions on this. The court's remaining conservatives in this, Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, dissented. And yes, this is wonky, and yes, this is confusing, because you've got justices writing in concurrence and dissent in support of what the ultimate, and in opposition to what the ultimate result is, which is sending this case back down. Elena Kagan, for example, in a concurring opinion, said the practical outcome of the court's decision would forestall harrowing consequences. She said the federal law ambiguously requires that hospitals receiving a Medicare funding provide whatever treatment is necessary to stabilize a patient, including pregnant women. Justice Jackson agreed with that. She said when the court allowed Idaho's abortion ban to temporarily go into effect, a months-long catastrophe ensued. And that could have been averted, she said, if Idaho if the action had been handled differently. She noted that Idaho physicians were forced to step back and watch as their patients suffered or arrange for their patients to be airlifted out. She said dismissing the case was a cause for concern, a path that simply allowed the court to avoid issues it does not wish to decide. There is simply no good reason not to resolve this conflict now. That is, again, Ketanji Brown Jackson among the opinions resolving this case. When we come back, more on that and more on other cases before the Supreme Court in their decisions of this past week.
This is the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. Look up cheese curds. You'll find this basic definition. Wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is the final segment of this, our first hour of this very special edition of Amicus Law Review on this Sunday afternoon. As a result of the decisions and the largesse and the support of the management of Civic Media, coming to you twice in one weekend, yesterday and also today, talking about these 9 or 10 cases pending before the Supreme Court, major decisions resolving issues in our life and our livelihood here in America, talking not only about this Fisher case and the decision by a majority of the Supreme Court over a strong objection, a strong dissent authored by Amy Coney Barrett, the Chief Justice telling us that the statute should be narrowly interpreted, and dismissing, rejecting the notion advanced by the prosecution that the statute should be broadly interpreted. Supreme Court, other courts do this kind of thing all the time, telling us what the law means. Here, in fact, they prescribe a more narrow interpretation. These cases now going forward, as will others presumably down the road, based upon that articulation of what the statute means and what it doesn't mean. Now talking about this abortion case, Moyle versus United States, many people looked at this case and said the Supreme Court now going to re-enter this fray, re-enter the issue, and decide whether or not a state prohibition on virtually all abortions, not every kind, but in Idaho, a virtual ban on abortion, whether that supersedes this federal law that requires that hospitals provide stabilizing treatment, including abortions for pregnant women in health emergencies. In the end, the Supreme Court decides basically not to decide, but along the way, issuing opinions in all kinds of directions. It is not intuitive. It is a bit confusing. But along the way, you've got, again, some relatively strange associations here, which you don't often see. Just talked before about the decision and the opinion and the writing of Ketanji Brown Jackson, saying that the Supreme Court that this is a cause for concern, dismissing the case in particular, that this simply allows the court to avoid issues that it does not wish to decide. She would take this on. And she says no good reason not to resolve the conflict. Now let's go at it, she says. And interesting again that Justice Alito sides with Justice Jackson and saying that the court should in fact have heard this case on the merits. Let's talk about abortion. Let's figure out which one of these applies, the state law or the federal law. But he comes to the opposite conclusion as to her. He says the abortion ban applied to emergency room care. The Idaho statute here does, in fact, supersede the federal law. To the contrary, he adds, the federal law requires hospitals receiving Medicare, which is the federal connection here, Medicare funding, and this is his language, to treat, not abort, an unborn child. And that important language there, because he does introduce that concept into this discussion about the statutes that are at play here. He expresses regret that the court lacked the desire to wrestle with this polarizing issue, and goes on to say that that question is as ripe for decision as it will ever be, this according to Justice Alito. Apparently, the court has simply lost the will to decide the easy but emotional and highly politicized question that the case presents. All of that coming from this opinion written by Justice Alito. Justice Barrett, again, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh, appeared to chart something of kind of a middle ground. She writes, the case should play out for now in the lower courts, We granted this review improvidently. We took this on too soon. A more complete picture of the facts could, in fact, emerge. The parameters of the Ohio law had significantly changed, she wrote, twice since the lawsuit began. And she added that the party's positions had rendered the scope of this dispute unclear, at best, all the more reason. Again, the upshot of all of this back and forth, all the disagreements about posturing here, mean that the Supreme Court does not decide the case in the end, sends it back down, improvidently granted, and waits for another day when this issue could, in fact, resurface. The upshot of both this case and the Mifepristone case is just that. Supreme Court not wrestling with ultimate decisions here, although plainly inviting back in the very discussion that animates these two decisions, both Mifepristone and, again, the Idaho case, having to do with the dispute, if you will, between the federal law and the state law, not resolved as a result of what the Supreme Court has done just this past week. Let's move to a criminal area, and let's return to our own circuit here. This is the Seventh Circuit United States Court of Appeals. As you well know from this broadcast and other shows on civic media, the Seventh Circuit comprised of the states of Wisconsin and Illinois and Indiana. And if you are unsatisfied with a civil or criminal result in any of the federal district courts, in any of those trial courts, in any of those three states, what do? You go to Chicago, which is where the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which is where we are, they hear the cases, they hear your appeals, and if you are further dissatisfied with the Seventh Circuit results, you can seek review before what? Before the United States Supreme Court. That's the petition for the writ of certiorari that we have talked about a lot, a petition that often is not granted. In most cases, the Supreme Court denies those. But again, in this year, 62 cases granted a petition for a writ of certiorari. And in this case, a case called James Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, Snyder versus United States. In this particular case, the United States Court of Appeals grants certiorari and says, yes, we'll review this case. Now, what happens here? What is the predicate for this case? Well, the former mayor of a place called Portage, Indiana, many of us probably have driven through or by Portage, Indiana, when you're in that neighboring state here in Wisconsin or other places from around the United States of America. He is convicted in federal court there in the Northern District of Indiana for bribery and accepting a $13,000 check, allegedly in return for some municipal trash truck contracts. That's a bit more of a simplified way of describing what happened at the lower court level. And the question is whether a particular statute, once again, applies to his particular conduct. And what is the nature of his conduct? What did he do? How do we describe that? And what does this particular statute prohibit in the federal code? We've got the same kind of issue as we had in Fisher. Here again, the court wrestling with what in this particular situation is federal statute number, yes, unfortunate, 666, 18 U.S.C. 666. The Supreme Court writing in the end that this statute prescribes and prohibits bribes to state and local officials, but does not make it a crime for those officials to accept gratuities for their past acts. That's what the Supreme Court resolves in this case. When we come back, as we review this case further, we'll talk more about what the Seventh Circuit did and about why this case, too, is important as the Supreme Court tells us more about what the criminal law in America means in 2024 and beyond.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we take a look back at what happened over the weekend and get you prepared for July 4th. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Do you owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
800-281-8193.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.